whole pile of Quantum Foundation summer school certificates. So it proves that you've been here. And I've signed each one of them personally. with some help from Kate. So if you can pass it around. You've got your name on, so you'll have to go through and find your name. I think it's just for the students. I don't think there's one for Adrian Kent. maybe you should check just in case. So that was the first announcement, so please keep this with Craig. So the second thing I wanted to say was, so we have a variety of backgrounds represented amongst the students here. Most of you are interested in fundamental physics, theoretical aspects thereof. So we have a postdoc program at the Perimeter Institute, and since we know already that you're very good, because we went through your applications for this school, we'd like to encourage you to consider applying to that program. We have string theory, cosmology, quantum gravity, quantum information, quantum foundations,
cosmology,
classical physics. And we take also interdisciplinary applications in things like condensed matter, which is an application to that. So look out for the adverts. I think the advert will come out in September, next month.
Week after next, on the webpage.
Yeah, and if you're not ready to apply to that this year, then we have that every year. So consider Perimeter as one possible place to do your postdoc. The other announcements. I have a bunch of books and resources for Quantum Foundations. I think what I'll do is I'll write this on the blackboard during the break, and then you can look at it there. So it's great to have Lee Smolin to talk during this last session. I was especially keen to get quantum gravity represented at this Quantum Foundation summer school, because I think that's one of the places that Quantum Foundations can do something real in physics. And Lee is the ideal person to talk about that. They're going to talk about quantum gravity in the light of quantum foundations. There's a lot of light.
It's in the light. Wait, Lucian, is something wrong with that? Is it there? Wait. That's it. There. Okay. So I'm talking about quantum foundations in the light of quantum gravity. Mostly what I have to think about is quantum gravity in the light of quantum foundations in my own work, but I think since this is a school with foundations of quantum mechanics, I'm going to talk about that. Now, a word of warning. I'm not here talking about my own work. So I'm not using this as an opportunity to give a seminar for my own work, as tempting as that was. What I'm going to be talking about is a viewpoint towards the field of quantum foundations that comes from thinking about the problem of quantum gravity. And I should say that what I mean by the problem of quantum gravity is the problem of finishing the conceptual change, or if you want to be ostentatious, the revolution in physics that began with Einstein and Ehrenfest and so forth, realizing that quantum physics was necessary and that quantum physics would be a great departure from classical physics. And in some sense, the foundational questions are questions which are left over from the realization that quantum physics is necessary, and then the invention and the erection of quantum mechanics as a version of quantum physics. So I want to distinguish between the physics that we know from experiments that nature is quantum mechanical, and a particular formulation of quantum physics called quantum mechanics that was developed between 1925 and 1927, which we teach and we study. Another aspect of that revolution was special relativity and then much more profoundly general relativity, which is a complete revision of Newtonian mechanics, but in a different direction in the physics of the meaning of space and time and gravity and cosmology. And the problem of quantum gravity is to put the different things together. Until the different things are put together, we don't have a theory of nature at all. Say, by analogy to the Newtonian Revolution, we can say that the Newtonian Revolution was begun in 1540 with the publication of Copernicus's book,
1543.
Thank you. Good.
Good.
Yes, good. Thank you so much. Saying that the sun was really near the center of the universe. It's not actually at the center of the universe, it's really Copernicus, but it was near the center of the universe. And 140-something years later, 1687, Newton's Principia, do I have it there yet? Yeah. Which continued it. And in the middle, you had great steps like Kepler's laws of planetary motion and Galileo's laws of quantum body and the principle of inertia and so forth. And I see relativity and quantum theory as analogous to Kepler and Galileo, that is, there's steps on the way, and the problem is put them together. Okay. So I'm going to, this talk is in two halves, which I hope will fit roughly with the two halves, with the 2 hours. In the first, I want to raise some issues that I think are additional issues that confront quantum foundations when you're thinking that the real task that quantum foundations contributes to is the completion of this revolution from Newtonian physics to something else that includes also cosmology, relativity, and quantum mechanics. In the second part, so here I'm just going to raise issues. And I may say things that people disagree with, and we'll see how much scope there is for raising and registering disagreement. But I recognize that much of the way that I'll raise the issues is deliberately provocative. And so you don't have to tell me that I'm being provocative, you just should be provoked. In the second half, I'll reach a conclusion, and that conclusion will raise a question, and the question will be, from the study of quantum gravity, what hints or lessons do we get towards a resolution of the problems of quantum foundations? And that would be the question that I'm asking in the second half. But for the moment, I'm looking for issues. Now, I also have an issue to start with. I like the lights on, but it means a little bit is the top of the finger is illuminated. Is that okay?
Yeah,
well, your option, the option is on. There. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, very good. So, the first issue that I'm going to raise, which has some sub-issues, is should a theory, quantum mechanics, invented to describe small subsystems of the universe, apply unchanged to the whole universe? That's my first issue. That is, the experimental basis for quantum mechanics is in, you know, atoms, molecules, collections of atoms, ensembles of atoms that may be large, say the ones that Tony studies, but still very small compared to the universe as a whole. Why should we presume that the framework, that is Hilbert spaces, algebras of linear operators in Hilbert spaces, etc., designed because of the experiments on small subsystems, apply unchanged to the whole universe? And there are some parts to this. First is the measurement problem, or what Lucian tells me I should call the reality problem. So let's talk about the measurement problem or the reality problem, but in the light of cosmology. What I mean by that is the assumption that we're studying the whole universe. And what I mean by the whole universe is a closed system that contains everything that dynamically influences it, contains all the clocks, measuring instruments that one might use to give meaning to physical observables, and contains also the observers. Okay. So I suspect that, I hope that other people in the school have brought up what the measurement or the reality problem is. We don't, for better or worse, when we make observations, the result of an observation is not a vector in a complex projective linear space. It's a bunch of pointer readers or registrations. We observe sometimes observables connected with particles, position, momentum, trajectories, or we observe waves with frequencies and wavelengths. We can make very good measurements of spectra, for example. Okay. How do we get from the quantum description to what we observe? And the reality problem, what's the actual relationship claim between the mathematical model, which is a vector in an infinite dimensional projective complex linear space, and reality? Now, the standard way that quantum physicists began talking about this is not the only way this is approached, but the standard way that people back in the 1920s and 1930s approached this is by dividing the world into system plus environment. The quantum system is the system of atoms or photons or whatever that we're describing. The environment is everything else in the universe and includes the measuring instruments, the clock, and I'll keep coming back to the special role of the clock, and we, the observers. Okay. In the initial formulations of quantum mechanics, back before people got fancy, this was talked about in terms of von Neumann rule 1 and von Neumann rule 2, and I actually think I've reversed them. Somebody can tell me if I have. Good, thank you. But rule 1 is that when we don't make a measurement, the state representing the system evolves unitarily in Hilbert space, and rule 2 is that rule, that probabilistic rule about when we make a measurement, which I assume everybody knows, so I won't leave it out. This raises the question, and I hope this has been raised before in the school, what is a measurement? What distinguishes when or when not a measurement is being made? Okay. And whatever answer we give to that question, the question that I'm raising, the new question, is can that question be answered in a way which applies to a system which is the whole universe that includes the observers, the clocks, and the measuring instruments? Okay, because there is, by definition, no external environment for the universe. If you think that something is the environment to the universe, then you should include it, because what I mean by a universe is the closed dynamical system, and that has nothing outside influencing. Okay, so there are various answers that have been given, assuming that quantum mechanics is correct. I mean, as I hope has been stressed, the subject of foundations of quantum mechanics divides, roughly speaking, into considerations that start with assume quantum mechanics is correct, and considerations that start with assume quantum mechanics has to be changed, what do we do? So I'm now in the class of assuming quantum mechanics is correct. And the first way that this was addressed is often associated with Bohr. And if you're interested in quantum foundations and you haven't read Bohr, I strongly recommend reading Bohr. Bohr is challenging, it's non-trivial, but I think he's saying something very interesting, something that I disagree with after a little thought and after more reading and more study. I still disagree with it, but I think it's a reference point and I think it's essential reading. And the only good thing is that Bohr is brief. So you only need to read a few essays of 5 or 6 pages, but I think it's worth reading. Bohr assumes the split of the world into a quantum system and the rest. He argues that we have to use classical language, that is the language of classical physics, when describing the rest and when reporting the results of observations. He sees physics as an extension of ordinary language, in which we extend ordinary language to discuss our observations of quantum systems. And it's, to me, it's a compelling way of thinking, even if I disagree with it. But by definition, Bohr's way of thinking cannot be applied to cosmology. And Bohr, if asked, I'm sure would have said so. Because Bohr assumes that quantum mechanics is of limited use for describing subsystems which are distinct from the observer measuring instruments. So Bohr is profound, but of no help. Now, Everett, who was a graduate student of John Wheeler, who was one of the people who began thinking and encouraging people to think about extending quantum mechanics to cosmology was motivated precisely by the question of, can there be an interpretation of quantum mechanics that applies to the universe as a whole? That's what Everett wanted to do. And the Everett interpretation is a claim to have done that. Many of us think it fails. And there are different reasons. So has the Everett interpretation been mentioned?
Yeah.
I don't have to review it. The one reason, okay, and many people say, and I heard Wojciech say this, that there's a distinction between the relative state interpretation, as is actually in Everett, which doesn't use words like many universe. And to quote many universe thing, I once asked Bryce DeWitt, by many universe, do you mean in the science fiction fantasy sense that there are actually these other universes going on with our own? And Bryce looked at me and said, of course. So whichever version you take, the relative state or the science fiction version of the Everett interpretation, many people believe that it fails because it does not explain what basis the splitting is done into, quote, different branches, which is the basis of introducing connection to experiment and probability. Sam, will you agree with that?
Yeah. No. I don't disagree with that. I just want to clarify. When we talk about universe containing everything, including the observers, when the observers are going to do measurements, whatever measurements are, you consider that the observers have free will.
I'm going to duck that question. Unless you can find a way to nail me to the wall and force me to answer it, I'm going to duck that question. I appreciate where you're going with that, and let's take it up later.
Okay.
By the way, what I really mean, the universe. I once heard a talk by Alain Cohn, the great mathematician at a conference, and he said we should be respectful when we talk about the universe. In fact, every time the speaker mentions the universe, everybody should stand up. So I don't think we should do that. But we should understand what ambition is. It's a very ambitious thing to think about extending physics, not from little systems we study in laboratories, but to, quote, the whole universe. Okay? And we should not be surprised if it's a hard question. Okay. Now, decohering histories, and I'm being here deliberately provocative because I have a lot of respect for Jim Murray and the other people who have invented it. I'm just assuming it. It's a fancy version of the relative state interpretation applied to histories, sequences of projection operators, etc., rather than space. And it has, Adrian with Faye Dauffer was, me wrote the definitive paper about this, although we've written papers since about this. It fails for a similar reason, which is, so roughly speaking, there's a identification of sets of histories that you can distinguish with probabilities rather than amplitudes called consistent histories. There's some mathematical condition for them. And there was the assumption that these correspond to physical reality, and there was a implicit belief, or at least impression given, that these were semi-classical. And what you guys did is demonstrate that there were an infinite number of, or a large number of sets of consistent histories which are not semi-classical, do not correspond to what we consider physical reality that we observe. Of course, it's possible to still maintain this interpretation, but with the radical redefinition of the notion of reality, which has many different simultaneous parallel versions of reality, even more radical than the Everett interpretation. And my personal view, because my taste for science fiction is limited, is that that means that the interpretation fails, although some people are attracted to it. Okay? Now, decoherence, as presented by Wojciech Zurek and collaborators, and as he presented here, is a different matter. And I want to distinguish it from decoherence. Decoherence is the study of how quantum systems in interaction with their environments rapidly converge for all practical purposes, which is a technical term, to statistical mixtures in which often classical or semi-classical quantities are distinguished as having probabilities. And in the context of a system coupled to an environment, as far as I can tell, it's correct. It's been experimentally probed and stood up, so it's real physics. It's a real explanation of how decoherence occurs. But it requires coupling to an environment. So therefore, it's not directly applicable to quantum cosmology, to the ambition to apply quantum mechanics to the universe as a whole. Now, maybe some version of it might be applicable to quantum cosmology, but if there is such a version, it remains to be developed. Okay. So I think decoherence is an important advance, and I did also especially like the Darwinian version that Wojciech talked about here. I think it is an advance on an advance, but it doesn't directly address the issue that I'm raising here. Okay, so my conclusion, which is meant to be provocative, after many years of trying, no interpretation of quantum mechanics extends convincingly to the cosmological case. There are several different interpretations of quantum mechanics appear to be adequate for the laboratory case of a subsystem of the universe, and I enjoy as much as the next person philosophical arguments among people who think for some reason only one of those interpretations should be correct. I mean, I don't take it too seriously because I think it's only part of this, it's an attempt to make philosophy just part of the story, but I enjoy those arguments. But none of those arguments convince me that any interpretation of quantum mechanics would help me if I start to write down the quantum state of the universe. I imagine that there's some Hilbert space, of everything in the universe that the quantum state of the universe lives inside. Yes?
So you didn't mention everything, obviously, but one striking missing thing seemed to be Bohmian mechanics. I mean, it doesn't seem to run.
I don't take Bohmian mechanics as an interpretation of quantum mechanics. I take it as in the second version of things, that is, what to do if you think quantum mechanics isn't complete. And I'll come to that. So this is a good point. Yeah?
Why do we need a theory of quantum mechanics that applies to the entire universe as opposed to just the chunk of it that I and we can see?
Maybe we don't. But since there's a classical theory of cosmology, and since it actually makes predictions like about the cosmic microwave background, okay, or about the distribution of galaxies, and since actually in those generation of those predictions, whether we believe them or not, is quantum mechanics, that is the statistics that becomes the statistics in the distribution of galaxies, starts off as quote quantum vacuum fluctuations in the standard formulation of cosmology. I would like to be able to understand those calculations in a non-ad hoc manner. Because the way that they're done now is you do classical cosmology, on top of that you play a little game with quote vacuum fluctuations. Then there's a little, when you're over here admiring the math, they do, like magicians, they do the trick over here where all of a sudden they make a measurement without telling who's making the measurement about the vacuum fluctuations, and they become, then you're back over here and they become density fluctuations, but they don't really tell you what they did. But don't pay too close attention to this hand. So I think that there's a need, since those are real predictions that are compared with real data, to understand them. But more deeply, I don't think we have a theory of nature, and I think this is part of what's missing. Newtonian physics is wrong, but Newtonian physics had no problem being extended to a theory of what was believed to be the whole universe. Okay. So I take this as license to investigate the second point of view, which is that there is a new theory needed. I mean, so there are arguments, there are internal arguments about, is quantum mechanics complete, is quantum mechanics incomplete? you know, Einstein, Schrodinger, Bohr, EPR, blah, 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 blah. There are all these arguments within the context of the foundational problems of quantum mechanics per se. What I claim is that there are, whatever you think of those, there are additional issues if you have, if you sign on to the ambition that there should be a single theory of nature and it should include cosmology. There are additional issues, some of which I've been raising. I haven't raised all of them. I've raised the more conceptual ones. There's a parallel set of technical issues, which I'm happy to talk about when I run out, if I run out of time. But there, let me just assure you, those are not the only issues. There are technical issues that come up from actually trying to make quantum theories of gravity and cosmology. And I take the lesson to be that quantum mechanics, if it's not incomplete for any other reason, it's incomplete because it's problematic extending it to cosmology. Yes?
So, my sidestep this stuff. You don't make it explicit, so this more complete theory should be deterministic, yes?
I'm not making a claim about that. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, but wouldn't you expect it to be deterministic because what's the probability for the whole universe?
That's the next question.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, thank you. But before I talk about the problem of probabilities, let me just note, because we are physicists, at least I hope. I mean, I'm glad there are some other, you know, mathematicians and philosophers visiting, but I am a physicist. And that means that whenever I ask a question about extending a theory, the very first thing I think about, even if I can't answer the question, is where do we expect to see the first correction? Okay? It's just an academic game to think about extending your theoretical framework if the first thing you don't focus on is where, what experiments we can do to tell the difference between your new and your own framework. Okay? The next slide is not an answer to that question. But I wanted to raise it. And if you really think that the new theory is coming because the world is cosmological, you know, then you might think that the corrections come at a scale of 1 over n, where n is sort of the number of degrees of freedom in the universe, which is like 10 to the minus 80, and then you get depressed.
Is that something that makes you think it's 1 over n and not 1 over square root of n?
Thank you. That's the next thing I was going to say. Now you don't get depressed, okay? Because this is the same as the weakness of the gravitational force. Okay? So you would expect to see corrections to quantum theory at the same point you see gravity, and maybe that's a big hint. But since gravity is observable, maybe those are observable. Thank you for that.
Ask about log n?
About what?
About logarithm n?
You are an optimist. Okay. Good. So that was the first issue. Okay, just to summarize to keep track of where we are. The second issue is probabilities. Thank you for that. Okay. Now, in quantum mechanics, there is this structure of the inner product. And we know that that's connected to probabilities. Connected to probabilities. And you're raised implicitly one issue about them, which is not the one that I'm going to raise. Okay, but let me mention the one that you implicitly raised. If there's just one case, what do we mean by probabilities? Okay? I'm going to raise that in a slightly different context a little bit later on, but I didn't really, I'm not, that issue is not sufficiently appreciated in this presentation, so it's not one that I'm focusing on. The one that I'm focusing on is time, because what do we mean by probabilities? What we mean is that there's a set of mutually exclusive outcomes, and we give them probabilities to occur. And I'm not going to get into the thing of the meaning of probabilities, even classically, which can quickly leave me speechless, because I quickly get confused by the smart things that people who think about the meaning of probability say. And I don't know if I'm a Bayesian or whatever, but or frequentist or whatever.
Okay.
But one way or another, probabilities are about mutually exclusive outcomes. And mutually exclusive outcomes for dynamics means things that might happen at the same time. So when you talk about probabilities as a notion of time normally implicit, you make an experiment, at some time you make a measurement, and there's a set of possible mutually exclusive outcomes, and you compute probabilities for them. Because, now here's a thing that you may not appreciate from ordinary quantum mechanics, but we who work in quantum gravity appreciate it very much. The inner product is chosen. That is to say, the definition of the inner product is a map from a Hilbert space to its dual space. And it's chosen. There is freedom to choose what the inner product is. Once you choose the inner product, it defines what is a Hermitian operator and what is a unitary operator. Therefore, that's part of the structure that's chosen. It's not it's not for free. Now, once you define who is Hermitian and who is unitary, you have unitary evolution. I wrote down the Schrodinger equation there, but that's equivalent to unitary evolution as long as the Hamiltonian is Hermitian. And that's unitarity is closely connected with conservation of probability. It's conservation of probability is a consequence of unitarity, that all the probabilities that could happen at one time add up to one, no matter what that time is. That fact that all the probabilities, you really have the complete set of mutually exclusive possibilities, you give them probabilities, they add up to one, and they always stay added up to one no matter what time it is. So there's an implication about that you're in control of what time is, which is hidden in the structure of the choice of the inner product. Now, in ordinary quantum mechanics, what is that time with respect to which evolution is unitary and probabilities are conserved? What is the T in the Schrodinger equation? What does it refer to operationally? It refers operationally to a clock outside the quantum system. The assumption is that you can read this clock classically, that there's no issue of quantum uncertainty or quantum fluctuations about the value of the reading of the clock. You never face a situation where there's an observable which measures the reading of the clock which doesn't commute with some other observable that you want to measure. The clock is always assumed to be outside the quantum system that you're studying operationally. What means by it mathematically is that the T as a mathematical object commutes with all the operators in the theory. It's a C number. Okay. Now, if your clock is a part of the quantum system, you don't get that. Right? Basically, visually, okay, here's your quantum system, here's atom, I don't know how you guys draw it. Okay. Here's the clock. And you have something that keeps track of the quantum state as a function of the reading of the clock. If you look at a larger quantum system that includes the clock, so that the state is the state of the atom plus the state of the clock, then it's complicated. And if you haven't thought that through, but you find it interesting, try to think it through. And you'll discover that all kinds of things can go wrong. If you try to discuss evolution of a system with respect to a clock, which is part of the quantum system, so that its reading is just one of the operators in the theory, and that operator doesn't necessarily commute with the other operators, then you don't get evolution, which is unitary with respect to the real physical clock reading. Now, since we think, just a second, since we think that clocks really are quantum mechanical systems, this raises the issue of what's the relationship between the T in the math and the reading of a real physical clock, which is a quantum mechanical system. Question.
So this isn't a really well-formed question, but I was wondering if you can kind of skirt this problem by kind of looking at probability as sort of a local thing you consider kind of like probability current instead of trying to fix a time for, you know, the entire universe.
I don't know, but I doubt it. Okay. Now, by the way, a number of people have tried to take advantage of this and study evolution by means of a clock inside the system. One of them is Gerald Milburn. Just to say that this problem has been studied. Another is two people, Gandini and Kulin. And they reach a nice conclusion, which is that physical observables described with respect to a clock that satisfies certain conditions as inside the system evolve like degrees of freedom of open quantum systems. And I forget the name of the equations, but they satisfy these equations that observables in open quantum systems satisfy. Has some standard name that I forget. Master equation. So this has been investigated to some extent, but I think it's a fundamental issue. And I think that time itself, the more and more that I think about this, and I've been thinking about these issues for a long time, the more I think that the scene of the prime is time, is our understanding of time. I'm not going to dwell on that now, but I think that this is a key issue. Now let me show you an implication. So how are dynamics and probability defined when there is no external clock? So we weren't born yesterday. People have been studying this problem for 40 or 50 years. And here's, roughly speaking, what happens. Here's quantum gravity in a nutshell. Okay. You start with the Schrodinger equation, which we just had, id by dt psi is h psi. But then you'd say the T refers to the rate of change of the system with respect to an external clock. Now you say there is no external clock. That's what I mean by saying that I have a cosmological system. Therefore, the quantum state should not depend on the reading of any external clock. Therefore, d by dt of the quantum state where T is an external clock should be zero. Therefore, the Hamiltonian on the state should be zero. The system, by definition, should be in an energy eigenstate with zero energy. And that equation appears in every formulation of quantum gravity that's remotely honest. Okay. It's called the Hamiltonian constraint equation. Now, that should make you very nervous if you haven't encountered this, because almost every practical application of quantum mechanics involves making wave packets. What do you do when you make wave packets? You take eigenstates of energy with different eigenvalues and you superpose them. And you get wave packets which are peaked around classical histories because the e to the I omega t's interfere with each other for when you take superpositions of states with different omega. But now there is no omega, or omega is equal to zero. So you can't make wave packets. So there's lots of stuff you can't do. Like you can't take states which are delta function normalizable, right, which are energy eigenstates typically are not normalizable states. If you just from basic, you know, think about plane waves. The plane waves, the basis plane wave basis states, which are energy eigenstates, are not normalizable. They have infinite norm. Okay? But you make plane waves, you make normalizable states. Now you can't do that. So there's a big issue with what's the norm? How do you get a probability? And these are big issues. And when you read papers in quantum cosmology, where they derive things like this, you know, the spectrum of the CMB, and then you see they've done it all with unnormalizable quantum states that have no norm and no definition of probability, and this really happens. Go read after the Mindy, for example. You get very nervous. Question?
I'm sorry, but I'm confused here. There exists no external clock.
Yeah.
And you say, therefore, if there was an external clock, psi couldn't depend on it.
This is not really the derivation of that equation.
Oh, good.
Okay, this is a hand-waving explanation for the derivation of that equation. But indeed, in quantum theories of gravity, quantum theories of cosmology, okay, the statement that there is no preferred time coordinate becomes the statement that the Hamiltonian is actually zero, is constrained to be zero.
So what's the meaning of the Hamiltonian in the absence of external time?
Classically, it's very clear. It generates evolution in the configuration space of the phase space. It has the same meaning. It's just the possible states of the system are constrained to have zero energy. I can show you this in an example. I'm not prepared to, but I can show you on the blackboard an example.
What is quantum general relativity?
Quantum general relativity, there are different approaches to it. So one of them is called loop quantum gravity. It's a set of approaches. And within that, this is completely well-defined, as that all the ingredients necessary for that equation are well-defined. There's a Hilbert space of states. There is a norm up to the issue that I just mentioned. There is an operator which is suitably constructed, and it has solutions. But because it's a zero-energy eigenstate, roughly speaking, it's hard to interpret those solutions.
I've read your book. I was just wondering how far that goes. I mean, does that include string theory and basically every quantum gravity, quantum general relativity?
Certainly there's a similar equation in string theory. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, it's called the Hamiltonian constraint on the string Wilson. Yeah. It's not quite the same meaning, but...
Yeah, I would say. not very long, I would say. Do you have any... taking the Hamiltonian constraint equation, do you have any overview of the solution set? Perhaps I'm asking too much, but...
No. I mean, there are some solutions which have nice WKD level interpretations.
Looks deceptive itself a lot. So you don't really, you can't.
It's remarkable that you have exact solutions.
Okay.
You have an infinite number of exact
solutions. So the situation becomes worse than, general relativity.
Yes, oh sure. Classical general relativity has a similar issue, but we understand it completely. And in an hour and a half or whatever that I have, I thought about it, but I don't really have time to explain that in detail. But let me just give the name if you want to study it. It's called the Dynamics of Fully Constrained Systems. And there are good treatments of it. The best one is a little book by Dirac from 1964 called Lectures on Quantum Mechanics. If you want the same thing in 500 pages, there's a book by Cano and Padovan, which has the same 50 pages with a lot of examples. Yeah. Okay. If I was in an optimistic frame of mind and trying to sell you the progress of quantum gravity, I would put it slightly different. I would say, in those infinite number of exact solutions, there's some about which we have some ideas about interpretation and physical consequences and so forth. But I'm here to emphasize the foundational issues. So not the issues where we think we know we can get away with them. Yeah.
Sorry for another question. The definition of your Hamiltonian is completely arbitrary, isn't it? Because you can define your Hamiltonian with respect to everything. So what you do in loop quantum gravity is you assume some time foliation in some direction, but you can define.
But I'm emphasizing here. Let me say what I'm saying. You pick a dynamical system which has the following invariants in it, that the time coordinate can be rescaled to any other time coordinate which is a function of itself. If the time coordinate happens to be a function of space, this is also a function of space. Okay? General relativity has that invariance. It's a gauge invariance. It means there's no preferred time coordinate. The fancy name for it is time reparameterization invariant. Okay? You take any classical system that has that property that you can rescale the time coordinate arbitrarily, and you will find as a consequence that the Hamiltonian is zero. Okay? And the challenge is to quantize that system.
So can I take an angle, for example, as part and
whatever you want, as long as it has this property, which is a consequence of general coordinate invariance and general relativity. Okay? But you can invent, if you write the free relativistic particle in a language where, for people who know it, where the action is the integral of dt of square root of x dot squared, happens to have that property because the square root makes it linear in 1 over dt, and then it's times dt, so if you change dt arbitrarily, the action doesn't change. Okay. So any system which has a reparameterization variance in time has a vanishing Hamiltonian. That is, the only solutions which exist of the Hamilton's equations of motion are those where the energy is strictly zero. Therefore, if you study quantum mechanics and you follow your nose, you end up turning that into an operator, annihilating the states. Okay? Now, I could spend the rest of the time talking about examples of that and implications of that, but it's nothing to do with loop quantum gravity or any approach. It's deeply in, it's a consequence of the general coordinate variance of general relativity, which is one of the principles of the theory. Okay? And people have been arguing about what's the right way to treat that since the 1950s. And one after another thing has been tried, and the fundamental issue remains, okay, what do you do with the notion of time when time is part of the system? There's some, now just to acknowledge this, there's some people who believe that what happens is that time is not fundamental at all, and you have a timeless theory in which there's nothing that refers to time at all in the formulation of the theory, and time, quote, emerges at the level of classical dynamics. And there are other people who think that time comes out of some subtle properties of the operator algebra, and all kinds of things in between. I'm just pointing out issues. I'm not here to advocate solutions. I mean, on a different day, I'm a proponent of different solutions of this, but I'm not here proposed solutions which are incomplete. I'm here to explain what the issues are. And there's a whole cluster of hard issues around this question. Okay. My conclusion, and again, this is not something that everybody agrees with, I'm being provocative, is that these set of issues and other issues like them that we people who study quantum gravity are familiar with are more reasons, besides the ones I already mentioned, to think that quantum formalism, as it stands, does not extend to the universe as a whole. For example, maybe the linearity of quantum mechanics is a consequence of a small number. In the rest of physics, wherever we see a linear equation, say the equation for small vibrations of a metal, it's an approximation to a nonlinear equation. Whenever we see a linear space of solutions, in the rest of physics, they're an approximate description of perturbations around a solution in a space of in a nonlinear space of solutions. Why should quantum mechanics be any different? Why should we take the linearity of quantum mechanics as anything other than an approximation? I don't know the answer, but I'm raising the question. Yeah?
You don't consider the linearity of the Liouville equation in classical Newtonian mechanics exact?
You got me there. That's one example. Thank you. Thank you. And I know where you are, and now I can imagine where you would go with that. Okay. Anyway, I'm raising it as a question. Okay. If there's a small number, like 10 to the minus 40, okay, which separates quantum mechanics from the Wright theory, then maybe you would expect the effects that come in to be nonlinear. Okay, there's nonlinear correction to the Schrodinger equation. Okay, and again, that's the scale at which gravity comes in, where the geometry of space becomes nonlinear. So maybe that's not crazy. Okay, so the issues we've talked about, what is probability without an external time, is the issue that I was just speaking about. Here's a different issue that worries me. In physics, traditionally, when we study real physical systems, and it was Galileo and Newton who taught us how to do this, we separate our description of a physical system into the question of what's the dynamical law and what's the initial conditions. And we separate those out. Okay? Does it make sense for the theory of the whole universe when there's just one instance? So that's my provocative question. Okay? There is what I'll call the Newtonian schema. Where's the hockey stick? The Newtonian schema for physical theories, and it works for a lot more than physical theories, for theories of computation, classical and quantum, etc. Okay? There's this configuration space. Now that's a pretty heavy thing, by the way, the space of all possible configurations of the universe at one time. It's one thing to talk about the space of all possible configurations of this coffee cup at one time. And you could sort of approximate that if you don't worry about the vibrations of the material by some finite number of parameters. Okay? But imagine you're talking about the space of all possible configurations of the universe at one time. And of course you have to tell me what one time means because of relativistic simultaneity, but even if you do that, I'd love to see you can do that. Okay? But this is the way we do physics. We define the system we're interested in, we write down the space of configurations of that system, and then we're done with the kinematics. That's called the kinematics. Then we write down the law, which gives us trajectories which are physical and distinguishes them from other trajectories which are not physical, because the dynamics picks out trajectories in the configuration space. And then given an initial configuration, and if this is this could also be phase space, if it's configuration space and not phase space, and a vector in the configuration space, you integrate it to get a trajectory and you can predict a later configuration. And so that's the way the classical mechanics works. That's the way that the theory of computation works. That's the way cellular automatons work. That's the way the quantum mechanics works. Only the configuration space is this high dimensional complex linear space and the evolution is unitary. So you don't have to give the derivative. Okay. Now, it bothers me, maybe it doesn't bother you, but it bothers me to just scale this thing up to a theory of the whole universe. Because most of the, I have several issues, not all of which I wrote down. One of them is that most of the configurations are never going to be realized in the history of our one universe. So what are they doing there? Another one is the computation problem. Where does this thing live? I mean, I can't write a computer program for a computer that I can build that can construct this. There are even mathematical issues of constructability, because in general relativity, the configuration space is an infinite dimensional space, which is a space of metrics on three-dimensional, or if you believe in nine dimensions, whatever, manifold, modified by an infinite dimensional group of equivalences, and nobody has ever given a constructive procedure to tell you whether two representatives of that are in the same equivalence class or not. So there are issues of constructability for the configuration space, which I didn't bother to write down. But it bothers me that this thing that we do, which works brilliantly when applied to subsystems of the universe, doesn't just scale up. Can we, in a controlled way, work with the, quote, configuration space of the whole universe? All right.
So there's no working algorithm to decide whether two given metrics are equivalent?
Are diffeomorphic, yes.
Yeah, oh.
Yeah.
Does this same argument apply to classical, like, say, general relativistic theories of cosmology as well?
The statement I just gave is about classical general relativity. In quantum gravity, there's an equivalent statement, which is even worse. The quantum states of certain graphs embedded in three dimensions topologically, and it's not known if there's an effective procedure to determine whether two graphs are in the same equivalence class or not, two graph embeddings. So either classically or quantum mechanically, there's an issue. And but there's also a big conceptual issue. And remember, this is the, you know, this is the real thing with all the complexity of the world. Here's a reason why we don't worry enough, I think. I think I, when I think about this stuff, I find it tremendously inviting to fall for a fallacy. And I'm constantly discovering myself in the throes of this fallacy, which is the fallacy, and I say it provocatively here, which is the fallacy of looking at the whole universe as if you're on the outside. Okay? And so I say it provocatively, this is the fallacy in which we physicists identify with God, or some notion of God, who is able to know the whole history or the whole state of the universe, forgetting the fact that we are somewhere inside the universe. The whole point of cosmology is that there is no such as Earth. And it's an interesting question whether that matters or not. And let me note, even in mathematics, it matters. And that is, there's a whole study of logics, and we were just, I'm looking out for my friend here who works with Chris Isham on topos theory, that there's a whole, yeah, so there's a whole approach to mathematical logic where it matters what you can actually argue and demonstrate from within a mathematical system. So even in pure mathematics, it's been understood that matters, and the fallacy of the, you know, infinitely smart mathematician outside the system who can just see it unfurled is a fantasy even for pure mathematics. So be, at least I find that I constantly have to remind myself not to fall for this fallacy. Okay, so those are the issues we have so far. There's one more which is related to that, which is impossible for any real observer to measure more than a fraction of the information in the universe. The quantum state of the universe is in fact unobservable. Right? And different people have emphasized this in the literature, in both classical and quantum cosmology. One is George Ellis, one is Fotini Montepulo. And let me explain the issue that they emphasize. Okay? But just classically to start with. Here is the space-time diagram of the universe. Here's me, here's you, here's the aliens over there. Okay. And here's our backward life form. This is what I mean by us, is here is us at some moment of time, some event where we're making an observation of the world. And we see the universe, what we see is a backward light cone. It's information coming to us up a backward light cone. Okay. And the causal structure of the universe doesn't have to be this way, but it happens to be because the quote Big Bang or the initial singularity is space-like, that is, the universe is not expanding from a point in classical general relativity. The initial singularity is space-like, which means a small amount of time after the initial singularity, the universe has a finite and possibly, in some models, infinite spatial extent. And any observer in the universe at a finite time sees only a finite amount of the initial conditions. Therefore, classically, it's impossible, in principle, for any observer inside the universe to identify where they actually are in that configuration space. And quantum mechanically, the wave function of the universe is unmeasurable. Okay, now, that, you could take the point of view that that's a practical problem, or you could take the point of view that that's a fundamental clue.
Well, that statement does not hold for a completely general class of structures, space-time structures.
But it happens to hold in our universe. Okay. And there's a set of fallacies that I find myself constantly falling into that I try to get out of. So one of them is the universe, you know, as an experiment, and, you know, God in his room trying to make a chicken and all of that. The other fallacy, this is that cartoon of the Far Side, but the other fallacy is something seems to have happened to theoretical physics in my lifetime, in which the study of theories of the universe turned into the study of possible universes described by possible theories. That is, I don't care that there might be other examples that have other properties. I care only about the theoretical description of the world that we observe ourselves to be in.
And we don't know the structure arbitrarily far back in time.
No, that's true. That's true. You're right. Thank you, and I stand corrected. It might be that the initial singularity is not there, that there is time before the Big Bang. In fact, I'm a big proponent of that idea in some other guises. Okay. And it might be that if you go back far enough before the Big Bang, the observer, any observer, can see the whole initial state. Thank you very much. That might be the resolution. I'm very happy to be nailed to the wall and corrected, because my job here is just to raise issues. Okay. Now, another way to approach this is to say that there are separate algebras of observables and separate states, which are going to be incomplete partial states to describe the knowledge of observers. And Fotini, Marco Polo in one way and Lucy in another way have been studying extensions of quantum theory which fit that. And I forget the gentleman's name, and Chris Isham. Andreas and Chris Isham have been studying other approaches in which, based on mathematical structures, which are based on the idea of incomplete knowledge, you can construct a physics in which observers always have incomplete knowledge. Okay, so those are my issues. Okay, so I'm wrapping up. My tentative to conclusion is that quantum mechanics, we know, applies well to subsystems of the universe, but my tentative conclusion, because there are so many of these issues, is that maybe quantum mechanics applies only to small systems of the universe, and a new theory is needed, which would have a new mathematical framework for the whole universe. This would not have, and here again, these are just possibilities. The proof is for somebody to actually pose something. There would not be. Just to read it off, there would not necessarily be a universal state, some pure quantum state of the whole universe, and an algebra of observables which is independent of the history of the universe and where the observer is. There would not necessarily be a separation of dynamics and kinematics. And by the way, this equation here, that the Hamiltonian is zero, is a blending of kinematics and dynamics. It says, even in classical general relativity, you think you know what the kinematics is, that is, geometry and rates of change of geometry, and it turns out that there's an intricate nonlinear condition that has to be satisfied, which is basically that the space-time has to have zero energy, in order that it have a consistent evolution, even classically. So the distinction between kinematics and dynamics falls apart. So I think we should take this seriously. A different but similar sounding issue is the separation between laws and initial conditions. Various things are said when people, so there's a line of thought that says the Big Bang is very special. So people like Jim Harlow, Roger Penrose talk a lot about this. The initial conditions, quote, of, quote, the universe, required to give the observed universe, seem very special, seem very unusual. How is that to be explained? People start talking about a theory of initial conditions, that the theory of the dynamics of general relativity or its quantum extension, whether it's string theory or quantum gravity, has to be supplemented by a theory of what are the initial conditions. What is a theory of the initial conditions but a law that just applies once? So you get this finite book of instructions. You get laws of nature, and then there's another law which you just get to apply once at the beginning. That's weird, to my way of thinking. To my way of thinking, what's happening is that the separation of what knowledge we have that we put into laws and what knowledge we have that we put into initial conditions, that division, which is highly useful when doing ordinary physics, is collapsing. This new physics would also not allow us to talk about observers outside the system, or even to fantasize about what the world would look like if we could measure from outside. Similarly, it would not allow us to even fantasize how the world is evolving with respect to a clock outside the system. And it seems reasonable, and I haven't given the full case, that when you lose these, you lose the linearity of the evolution. Unless you take a point of view that it's all just information, and it's like Google theory. But I'll leave that for discussion. Such a theory would have to use only observables accessible inside the system and refer only to time in terms of changes observable from inside the system. So that's the conclusion of my first rant. And I hope at least I've been provocative. And then when we come back, if anybody comes back, what I'll do is change tacks a little bit, and I'll talk about what hints towards the constructions of such a theory come from some work on quantum gravity in which one has just put on one's blinders, ignored these questions, and just tried to apply quantum mechanics to gravity and cosmology. And if there's any justice in the world, trying that blind approach should run you back into the same obstacle course that thinking runs you into. But maybe we get some hints from actually what happens when you actually try to quantize gravity. And I'll argue that there are some hints. Thank you.
We'll break the coffee first. Oh, did you have your question?